And I don't see him, so he's got to be back here for that. All right, page 3 in your, what we call it, the seminary, your syllabus, your booklet. First time I've been here in this this church, this building, and with the church, with the people of God here in this place, and what a privilege it is to see how the Lord has blessed in this ministry. Although every time I see Scott, he's a former student of mine, I think he's picking up some characteristics of an individual I know he loves and has studied. Every time I see him, he looks more like Charles Haddon Spurgeon. Now, if you take the glasses off, isn't he? I mean, that's Charles Haddon Spurgeon. It really is. You know, if you become associated with a person long enough, you know, you pick up their characteristics. And I say that as a compliment. He's one of my heroes. I don't know if Scott will appreciate that, but I hope he does. All right. 3 remarkable and not unrelated events occurred in early American Baptist history that prompted our Baptist forefathers to seek the practical fulfillment of the Great Commission. And let me just say that the presentation this hour is really to challenge us to follow the example of our Baptist forefathers in church planting. This is meant to be an incentive. This is meant to be a challenge to us all to be about the work of the Great Commission in multiplying local New Testament Baptist churches. Well, setting in motion the heroic evangelistic enterprise of the Baptists were the establishment of the First Baptist Church of America in Providence, Rhode Island, 1638. Today, you can visit there. The sign out front says, First Baptist Church of America, 1638. Today, the name Baptist really doesn't belong to that church because they have forfeited what the term Baptist really means. Today, that church is thoroughly liberal, but it meant something back in Roger Williams' day when he founded that church. Secondly, the creation of the First Baptist Association in America in Philadelphia in 1707. 3 more years we'll be celebrating the tricentennial of the founding of the First Baptist Association in America. And then thirdly, the pioneering missionary efforts of the separate Baptists in the South by the Sandy Creek Association beginning in 1758. I'm not sure if we'll get as far this morning or this afternoon with the third effort with the Sandy Creek Association, but let's see how far we can go. These ministries were all born out of the desire for unfettered religious freedom. Baptists have always been at the forefront of this struggle for religious freedom from the very get-go. A fervent love for the souls of men and a holy ambition to preach the unsearchable riches of Christ's gospel as the means of their salvation from sin and entrance into eternal life. They were produced in answer to intense and persistent prayer. We'll notice later, concerts of prayer were instituted with the realization that we must depend completely and wholly upon God for the advance of the gospel, the planting of local churches. Well, first of all, let's look at the First Baptist Church in America and church planting. What a paradigm, what a model this First Baptist Church was for so many years for many other churches with regard to church planting. Of course, we know the First Baptist Church started by Roger Williams, Providence, Rhode Island, 1638. I call him the delinquent father of Baptist history because he did not remain a Baptist for very long. He became what was called later a seeker. And so he left his church after founding it, and it's left some wondering, was he really a Baptist at all? Well, a close friend of his back in England, one of the governors of Massachusetts, John Winthrop, indicated that indeed he was. A sister, Mrs. Ann Hutchinson, being infected with Anabaptistry, going last year to live at Providence, Mr. Williams was taken, or rather emboldened by her, to make open profession thereof, and accordingly was rebaptized by one Ezekiel Holloman, a poor man late of Salem. Then Mr. Williams rebaptized him and some 10 more. They also denied the baptizing of infants, or pedobaptism, and would have no magistrates governing the churches. And these are two fundamental principles, of course, of Baptist ecclesiology: separation of church and state, and believers' baptism by immersion. So we see Roger Williams doing that right at the beginning. Excerpts from another church, the First Baptist Church of Boston, 1665, express well the sentiments of early New England Baptists, including the Providence Church. Let me just recite here some excerpts from their statement of faith. Christ, His commission to His disciples is to teach and baptize. And those that gladly receive the word and are baptized are saints by calling and fit matter for a visible church. Here again, believers' baptism by immersion. And a competent number of such joined together in covenant and fellowship of the gospel are a church of Christ. And then a little bit later, point Q, and this church hath power to receive into their fellowship visible members or believers. If any prove scandalous, obstinate, wicked to put forth such from amongst, or and wicked to put forth such amongst them, they ought to meet together the first day of the week to attend upon the Lord and all His holy ordinances, continuing in the apostles' doctrine and fellowship, and breaking bread and praise. Excellent statement of faith. Far as we know, the first statement of faith of an organized Baptist church in America. Now, the First Baptist Church of Providence, or the First Baptist Church in America, experienced some instability from 1638 to 1771. As I said, Williams remained there only for a few months and then left, rejecting his baptism as invalid because it was not practiced by an apostle or a successionist from an apostle. He began to hold successionist baptism. In 1652, the First Baptist Church split over doctrine, mainly Arminianism versus Calvinism. The majority had become six principal or general or Arminian Baptists, and so this caused a split. Reunification took place by 1718. The Arminians found themselves in the minority in 1771 and left to establish another church. But I look at the coming of James Manning beginning in 1771 as a new opportunity of the advance of the gospel regarding First Baptist of Providence. Before 1734, there were in New England only 15 Baptist churches in all variety. Only 33 Baptist churches existed in all of the 13 colonies. Just 33 Baptist churches in the colonies. But by 1750, there were 58 churches in New England alone. Phenomenal growth. By 1795, this number had increased to 325. What caused this tremendous growth in Baptist churches? Well, much of it can be attributed to the energetic church planting activity of First Baptist Church under the leadership of James Manning and his Calvinist successors. Manning came to the church as its 12th pastor in 1771. Actually, he was in the area as pastor of First Baptist of Warren, but after a period of time, in fact, after he became president of the first college in America, Rhode Island College, which is today Brown University, he became pastor of First Baptist of Providence. Well, what made the difference in his ministry and the ministry of First Baptist Church Providence? Two words, or three words, the Great Awakening. That's what made the difference. He embraced the Great Awakening. He was a revivalist of sorts, even though he was an educator and a pastor. And so I mention here, citing Stanley Lemon's work, which is the history of the First Baptist Church in America, written in 1988, an excellent work. He says, it's ironic that most of the old Arminian Baptist churches in New England were feeble in their outreach. They believed in general atonement, that salvation was possible for all people, but they tended to look inward. On the other hand, the great expansion of Baptists in the 18th century arose through the Calvinist, or particular Baptists. By the way, here in America, they were normally called regular Baptists, but particular Baptists in England, but the terms are interchangeable, and came as a consequence of the fervor of the Great Awakening, which was a revival of Calvinist beliefs. Now, Stanley Lemons is a Baptist of sorts, but he is really not evangelistic. He's really a liberal. He teaches in liberal schools. He's really not necessarily sympathetic with what he's talking about here. He's simply stating facts of history. He says, eventually, most New England Baptists were transformed by the Great Awakening into the particular or regular variety. Nearly all of the Arminian General Baptist churches in New England, as a result of the Great Awakening, were transformed into regular or Calvinistic Baptist churches. Folks, this is the result of evangelism, of revival. And many today look at it as just the opposite. I mean, you cannot be Calvinistic and evangelistic at the same time. That's oxymoronic. But there it is. It happened. Most Baptist church planting during the Awakening was due to the efforts of the regular Baptists. They were the ones evangelizing. These Calvinistic Baptists were the ones that were shaking up the whole area through revival preaching, through church planting. God was using them in a remarkable way. Another result of the Great Awakening was the establishment of new colleges in order to produce educated ministers for denominational churches. Newside Presbyterians began the College of New Jersey, and other schools were started there that you can read about for yourself, but a tremendous amount of evangelistic and educational activity as a result of the Great Awakening. Another reason for the growth of Baptist churches was the phenomenal energy and vision of separate Baptist leader Isaac Backus. Isaac Backus, we read about quite a bit with regard to the struggle for religious freedom. He was in the vanguard of that struggle in Massachusetts. And he was very effective in the Great Awakening. In fact, he was a convert of the Great Awakening and co-founder with James Manning of the Warren Association. This was the first Baptist association in Rhode Island, in the Massachusetts, Rhode Island area. And from his church in Middleborough, Backus made over 900 trips, traveled 68,000 miles, and helped to establish scores of Baptist churches. He was an indefatigable worker. My wife and I had the privilege of visiting the First Baptist Church of Middleborough. It's a new building, of course, today, pastored by an evangelical. When we visited there, and a senior couple took us to the cemetery where Isaac Backus is buried. And there at the cemetery, we saw his headstone in the shape of a pulpit. Well, that exemplifies his ministry perfectly. He was all over the place, preaching at every opportunity. I mention here from the diary of Isaac Backus, his own words, William G. McLaughlin citing his words here, rather. It's significant that Backus himself believed that the old Baptists in New England were not true Baptists because they were not good Calvinists. He considered most of them Arminian. During the early years of Backus's career as a separate Baptist, after he had reconstituted his church on closed communion, anti-pedo-Baptist principles in 1756, he applied himself to the task of persuading other separate churches to adopt his principles and spreading the new evangelical Calvinist principles among the old Baptists. Backus considered that virtually all the old Baptists in Massachusetts and six principal Baptists in Rhode Island were tainted with Arminianism. And as a strict Calvinist, a follower of the New Light theology of Jonathan Edwards, he could not hold fellowship with them. Now again, here is a man writing who is not in sympathy at all with Calvinism or with Jonathan Edwards or with Isaac Backus. He's writing strictly as an historian, William G. McLaughlin. He was a liberal. As a result of his endeavors, nearly all of the old General Baptist churches in New England were converted to separate or regular Calvinist Baptist churches. And again, look at the statistics here of his endeavor. In 1740, there were 31 Baptist churches of all varieties, more than double the number from 1734. By 1777, Backus had listed 119 closed communion Calvinist Baptist churches, and by 1795, there were 325. That's an incredible increase. The Warren Association, founded in 1767, modeled after the Philadelphia Baptist Association, was formed for the multipurpose of advancing union among Baptists, maintaining faith in Calvinism, anti-pedo-baptism, addressing grievances to colonial governments against religious restrictions, and planting new churches. That was certainly an aim of the Warren Association. McLaughlin writes, "The Warren Association was successful in all of its aims. By 1780, it had 38 member churches, mostly in Massachusetts. And by 1804, there were 13 Baptist associations in New England." 13 Baptist associations with 23,638 members from 312 churches. Again, how do we account for this tremendous growth, the Great Awakening? Well, as a leader of the Warren Association, First Baptist Church of Providence was a vital part of this growth. Let's turn now to point C, the First Baptist Church under the leadership of another strong Calvinist evangelistic preacher, Stephen Gaino, beginning in 1792. Stephen Gaino was the son of the famous John Gaino and also a nephew of James Manning. And he served as pastor of First Baptist Church for 36 years. Lemon states his ministry was marked by the greatest growth in the history of the church, and he presided over several revivals and the planting of four daughter churches. A National Baptist leader, he traveled widely to mediate problems and to encourage new congregations and missions. He was one of the founders of the Triennial Convention, the first foreign Baptist agency in America, 1814, and the founder of the first and first president of Rhode Island Baptist State Convention. Under him, First Baptist entered into the home and foreign missionary movements, as well as the Sunday school movement and the Bible and tract societies. Gaino studied to be a doctor, a physician, but was converted. God called him into the full-time ministry, and he planted many churches as a result of his work, not just in Providence, but elsewhere. Under Gaino's ministry at First Baptist Providence, the church grew to be one of the largest Baptist congregations in the country. And again, one reason for growth was revival. I mentioned here four awakenings that occurred during his ministry as pastor there. Members added, and this would include by baptism, so you can see the number of new members, not just transfers from other churches. So these would be new converts by baptism. By 1821, First Baptist Church counted 648 members. That was a good-sized church back then, still is today. But certainly back then it would have been. Well, what was First Baptist Church's procedure of establishing new churches? Well, this involved a procedure, I believe, that Baptists have continued to use to this day and ought to be used. Transferring of members, transferring of funds. Second Baptist Providence organized May 1805 with 16 original members. 13 came from First Baptist Church. 50 years later, when Second Baptist needed a new building, First contributed $4,900. That's the equivalent today of about $90,000. Then there's First Baptist Pawtucket, organized August 27, 1805, with 39 original members, 33 from First. Hey, First Baptist Church just kept loaning out its members. Giving up of its members. As God blessed them, brought more people in, we'll just farm them right out to start new churches. Pawtuxet Baptist, organized November 18, 1806. All of the initial 34 members were from First Baptist. There was Third Baptist, organized in 1821. All of the original 16 members were new converts in the revival of 1820 and came from First Baptist. Within a year of the first pastor's installation, Third Baptist split over the issue of free will. Several of the founding members returned to First Baptist. They said, we're not going to sit under the ministry of an Arminian. This was founded as a Calvinistic Baptist church, so they left it. And later on, when it returned to the fold of Calvinism, it was readmitted to the Warren Association, and the people returned to the church. Stephen Gano and First Baptist helped to found the Massachusetts Baptist Missionary Society in 1802. Gano's daughter, Margaret, and a female friend, Eliza Pittman, started the Female Mite Society at First Baptist to collect money for the support of Baptist missionaries. Enough money was raised, as I mentioned, by 1825 for the creation of the Rhode Island State Baptist Convention. And that convention was begun for the purpose of facilitating domestic and foreign missions. In other words, church planting. Even the ladies got involved. You see the dedication of these people? It wasn't just the pastors doing it, it was the people involved, willing to sacrifice themselves to move out of their own community to help start another church with their abilities and with their funds. What a tremendous incentive this is for us. We go on, First Baptist Church after 1828, more church planting. Condon Street Baptist Church was started by blacks who attended First Baptist in Providence. They were welcome to the services there. But they wanted their own church, and so First Baptist helped them to start their own church. And again, if you go to Providence today and you see First Baptist Church just up the street at Condon, there is that black Baptist church still functioning there, not as a conservative church, unfortunately. But that's the church that was started. Then you have 8th Baptist, or Smith Hill, organized May 1847 with 13 of the 29 founding members from First Baptist. And here's an example again of how this came about, this procedure. In 1849, 1850, the Young Ladies Bible class was directed by a John Joles from First Baptist. The following year, three members of First paid off half of the indebtedness of 8th Baptist. When the church built a new meeting house and changed its name to Jefferson Street Baptist Church, $2,000, which is the equivalent of $40,000, was given by First Baptist for the construction. Again, a financial crisis took place. First Baptist kicked in, contributed $1,132, and please change that number, if you would, to $26,000. That's what it should be, not 16, but $26,000. That would be the equivalent today. So here is a pattern. You see this pattern of people and finances going out generously from First Baptist Church to help in the founding and in the continuation of these other Baptist, these sister Baptist churches. So throughout the 19th century, First Baptist contributed to the planning and sustenance of many Baptist churches throughout Rhode Island and the country. And I've given you here just a partial list of those churches that were started, some of which right here in Illinois. Rock Island, Galesburg, Illinois. First Baptist Church helped to start those churches. There was the Sunday school contribution as well. The Sunday school, you remember, was started by Robert Raikes in England in 1780 to help factory worker children to learn the three R's. So it was an early home school program, you might say. And First Baptist adopted it along the same lines to teach these factory kids their ABCs. In fact, Rhode Island was one of the richest states in the country at one time. It had 100 mills going full tilt, textile mills, either cloth or leather mills, and brought in a lot of money. And there were well-to-do people attending the church that received the benefit of that work. But the children needed attention as well. And so they started a Sunday school to train these children and also to evangelize them. And as a result, revival occurred, and many of these children, even some of the teachers, were saved. And God used that to strengthen the church even further. However, point E, First Baptist Church became a casualty of Finneyism by the 1850s. So-called New Measures Revivalism contributed to a transformation of First Baptist Church in the 1850s. Again, Stanley Lemons writes, a major casualty was Calvinism, with its doctrine of particular or limited atonement. When the century began, particular Baptists, like those at First Baptist, regarded free will Baptists to be utterly wrong. An adoption of the free will idea that everyone at least had a chance at salvation led to expulsion from the church. And I think Lemons is overstating it here, but he's trying to make a point here of what happened. As stated earlier, free will Baptist churches were excluded from association with the regular Baptists. But by the late 1850s, this hostility had faded substantially as American Protestants in general moved toward the free will idea. The Calvinist notion that only a predetermined few could be saved was felt to be incompatible with the revivalist and missionary impulses. The Calvinism of First Baptist had simply evaporated in the 1840s. And notice what he says here. This is incredible. With the decline of Calvinism came a fundamental change in the way individuals gained entry into the First Baptist Church. Before, one had to be able to testify to a definite and profound conversion experience. That was the old Puritan way of doing it. And the Baptists, of course, included that as a necessary aspect of their ecclesiology. You had to give a profession of faith before you could become a member of the church. That stands to reason. But that fell by the wayside. Such a stringent requirement prevented any number of individuals, such as Nicholas Brown, for whom Brown University is named, from ever being baptized into the church. Nicholas Brown attended that church regularly, but they never allowed him to join that church because he refused to make a profession of faith. Now, you talk about the pressure on that church to admit him. I mean, he was Mr. Moneybags. He had the money to help finance a lot of these projects. And, of course, he gave a great deal of money to Rhode Island College, so much so they changed the name to Brown University. But here was a church governed by principle. We're not even going to let this man join our church until he can give a profession of faith. That's an excellent example, but all that changed. Such persons might live righteous, upright lives and believe the tenets of Christianity, but never undergo the experience of conversion. However, by the 1840s, some began to gain admission by affirming the beliefs of the church, not by testifying to a conversion. And so the church membership became diluted. And as a result, to this day, by the change of the last century, it became thoroughly liberal, and it certainly is today. So First Baptist Church of Providence succumbed to modernism, one of the most liberal churches in the country. Well, we want to shift gears now and go to the Philadelphia Baptist Association and church planting. This is the granddaddy of all Baptist associations in America. The founding of the First Baptist Association, 1707. The Baptists enjoyed the greatest liberty in the Middle Colonies. They were persecuted in both the New England colonies and in the Southern colonies because of Congregationalism in the North and Anglicanism in the South. But men like William Penn, a Quaker proprietor of Pennsylvania, said, come one, come all. as long as you keep the peace, you can come on in and be a citizen of our new colony. Other proprietorships like the Jerseys and Delaware welcomed them in as well. And so they enjoyed a great deal of religious liberty. So it's no mystery to understand that they enjoyed a great deal of freedom there, and many came there. Well, in 1688, the Pennepec Lower Dublin Baptist Church was organized with 12 members under the leadership of Elias Keach. Elias Keach was the son of the famous Particular Baptist Benjamin Keach, whose church in Suffolk, England became the precursor of the Metropolitan Tabernacle. Bev and I, my wife and I, had the opportunity last June to visit London. We went to the Metropolitan Tabernacle, visited the current pastor, Peter Masters, and he welcomed us into his office, quite the gentleman. It's been a long time since I've heard a man pray for 15 minutes. 15-minute prayer, like a sermon, eloquent prayer. And quite the gentleman, he showed us the portraits of former pastors. One of the former pastors had been there for 61 years. He said, "I've just gotten started. I've only been here 32 years. But Elias Keach was son of the famous Particular Baptist Benjamin Keach. But Elias Keach, when he came to America, came as an imposter. He was dressed in the clerical garb. And back then, Baptists dressed like most Anglican ministers, with the powdered wig and the bands and the black robe. And that's the way he came. He needed a job. So he impersonated a Baptist preacher. And at first, the people there at Pennepec were taken in. He began preaching. And during the sermon, he underwent severe conviction and was actually saved while he was preaching. He confessed his sin. He confessed his imposture. And the people forgave him and voted him in as their new pastor. I don't recommend that as a normal course of things. But he made it. He made it. Of course, it helps when you get saved, you know. I mean, it really does. It makes a difference. Well, he became a church planter immediately. That's what we do. That's what Christians do. That's what Baptists do. They win others to Christ. They start churches. And so he started these other churches that I mentioned here, at least most of them, and they collectively eventually became, by 1707, the Philadelphia Baptist Association. Its purpose was fourfold: to provide advice and counsel for the settlement of disputes, to discipline errant ministers, to warn churches of imposters, and to act as a council of ordination. The minutes of July 1707 read, "It was agreed that a person that is a stranger, that has neither letter of recommendation, nor is known to be a person gifted and of good conversation, shall be admitted to preach or be entertained as a member in any of the Baptist congregations in communion with each other." It is also concluded that if any difference shall happen between any member and church he belongs to, and they cannot agree, and then the person so grieved at the general meeting appeal to the brethren of the several congregations. Now, if you read on, it suggests these statements suggest a kind of a Presbyterian type of polity here. And one of the reasons for that is because the early constituency of the Philadelphia Association were Welsh Baptists. And the founder of the Welsh Baptists was a regular Baptist by the name of John Miles. And he founded the first Baptist church in Wales around 1636 or so. And he was convinced that a Presbyterian-type polity was essential to keep these churches in line. And so some of the Welsh Baptists coming over continued to practice Miles' type of polity. But they soon realized this violated New Testament Baptist polity. So I mention here, it should be added that the association had no absolute binding power on the churches. It was a voluntary body with the final discretion left to the local church. The association would not jeopardize the principle of church autonomy. And hence the term association rather than convention. You can read the fine print there that continues to comment on that phenomenon. Going on to point three, a remarkable spirit of unity prevailed throughout the colonial history of the Philadelphia Baptist Association, evidenced by the circular letter of greeting sent to member churches in 1729. Look at the excerpt. These are the kinds of edifying letters that you receive or you see regularly in the minutes of the Philadelphia Association. Dearly beloved brethren in the Lord Jesus Christ, we heartily rejoice to see your care, diligence, requests, and desires on our behalf at the throne of grace, and also your care and diligence in maintaining our yearly correspondence and communion in the gospel. We, your representatives, met together in love, perused your letters, and gladly received your messengers. We find cause to rejoice that God has crowned the labors of his ministers with such success. There have been considerable additions the past year in several churches, and some in most. Praise be rendered to our gracious God. We find the churches generally to be at peace and unity amongst themselves. We think it expedient to give you an account of our proceedings. We conferred together without any jars or contentions in our debates. Our souls have been refreshed, hearing of the welfare of the churches in general, also in hearing the sweet and comfortable truths of the gospel declared among us by the faithful labors of our ministering brethren, which we hope is to the glory of God and the good of souls. We earnestly desire you to walk worthy of our holy vocation, standing fast and striving together for the faith of the gospel. Usually they would meet in October of the year. The various representative pastors would come together. They would discuss various resolutions affecting the churches and inquiries of those member churches and decide what types of policies that they would enact. But of course, the local church would have the freedom to either follow through on the policy or not. Most would. And one of those policies was enacted in 1742 that resulted in the Philadelphia Confession of Faith. One of the reasons it took them so long to come up with a confession of faith, 1707 to 1742, is because, again, the autonomy of the local church. Most of the member churches already had statements of faith, so they did not want to interfere with the autonomy of the church. But most were in agreement already on the Second London Baptist Confession. This was a confession that Baptists in England had been using now for many years. And they thought, well, we're basically in agreement with this. Why don't we just adopt it as our own confession? So they did in 1742. And this 1688 London Baptist Confession was based upon, with very few changes, on the Westminster Confession of Faith. They baptized the Westminster Confession, made it applicable to Baptists. It was, of course, the Westminster Confession was Presbyterian. They made it Baptist and renamed it the Second London Baptist Confession. And then these American Baptists made it their own, the Philadelphia Confession of 1742. Imagine that, the Westminster Confession showing up in a bunch of Baptist churches in New England. Or in Philadelphia, rather. Benjamin Franklin published that confession. And Torbett says, thus the association, by an adroit coupling of a Calvinistic confession of faith with a definition of its relationship to the member churches, was in a position to change the bent of Baptist theology in the colonies. And indeed it did. We note here some church planting in connection with the Philadelphia Baptist Association and some very fortunate influences on the association. Once again, the Great Awakening facilitated Baptist expansion. Because of the Great Awakening's emphasis on Calvinism, complemented by particular Baptist theology, because of the agreement with the Great Awakening, by and large, with regard to doctrine and certainly the doctrine of regenerate church membership, these particular Baptists really grew. Another influence was Andrew Fuller's theology of the atonement and its implications for missions. Andrew Fuller, William Carey, those names should ring a bell with you. These men were the founders of the First Baptist Association and, in a sense, the founders of modern missions, with the British Particular Baptist Society 1792 that sent Carey and Thomas to India in 1793. Notice the procedure of organizing new churches by means of commission. There were two procedures, one by commission, one by itinerancy. And to save time here, let me mention these briefly. With regard to commission, the Philadelphia Association would actually commission evangelists at large. These men were local pastors, for the most part, who received permission from their local churches to go out as evangelists at large, not necessarily for what we normally think evangelists would do today, hold weekend or week-long meetings and trying, you know, getting folks saved and so forth. These evangelists would go out for church planting. They would go out to encourage and to help reestablish weak churches. And one, Morgan Edwards, actually went out as an evangelist at large to gain information from various churches throughout the colonies to put together a Baptist history. So they function in different ways. But in the decade of 1750 to 1760, one evangelist at large went into the Carolinas, John Gano, and he helped to transform the Arminian General Baptist churches down there into particular or regular Baptist churches. Those churches, those regular or the Arminian Baptist churches, were allowing people into their membership through baptism alone, without any profession of faith, any acknowledgement that they were born again people. So much for regenerate church membership. John Gano literally took the Philadelphia Confession in hand and presented this before congregations and held evangelistic meetings and inquired as to the profession of faith of many of these people who had come into the church, and as a result, revival broke out. Many of these people were saved. The churches were reconstituted on the basis of the Philadelphia Confession of Faith. Incredible, remarkable change. And so most of these churches became regular Baptist churches. The holdouts, those who did not wish to join up, there were a few of them, became the nucleus of the Free Will Baptist movement in the South. So some other statistics here. I know some numbers can bore you here a little bit, but on the next page, point B, between 1743 and 1762, Philadelphia Baptist missionaries planted at least four churches along the Atlantic coast as far south as Charleston, South Carolina. And then you can notice these others here that are mentioned. Following the lead of the Massachusetts Baptists, who organized a missionary society in 1802 to plant churches throughout the region, Philadelphia Baptist Association began the Philadelphia Baptist Missionary Society. And this was designed mainly to win the native Indians to Christ. After the conversion of Adoniram and Ann Judson and Luther Rice from Congregationalism to the Baptist Church in 1812, and the resulting desperate need for an organized effort to support foreign Baptist missionary efforts in Burma and elsewhere, Rice returned home to solicit support for a Baptist missionary agency. Here, the first foreign mission agency in America was not founded by Baptists, but by Congregationalists, called the Independent Board of Foreign Missions. And so Luther Rice, who was a bachelor, and the Judsons set sail under the sponsorship of the Congregationalists for India. And on the way over to India, you have a lot of time on your hands when you're riding a slow sailing ship. And they read their Bibles as good Christians and realized, hey, infant baptism is not in my New Testament. They became Baptists on the Atlantic Ocean sailing to India. And when they got there, Carey's group, I think it was Marshman, who baptized them. So that severed their ties with Congregationalism. And to make a long story short, the Judson sailed on to Burma to pioneer a mission there and did a remarkable work. Luther Rice came back home and organized Baptist missions, and the culmination of his efforts was called the Triennial Convention, 1814. Obviously, it met every 3 years, hence the name. One of the domestic missionaries that did a phenomenal work was John Mason Peck. He also grew up in a Congregationalist home and became, in fact, a member of Lyman Beecher's church. You've heard of Harriet Beecher Stowe, Uncle Tom's Cabin. That was one of his 13 children that wrote that book. Three different wives, 13 kids. All of them went into the ministry of one kind or another. Lyman Beecher was the dad of those kids. But Lyman Beecher could not explain to the satisfaction of Peck and his wife pedobaptism. So they joined a Baptist church in New Durham, New York. That year, God called him to preach, and he began reading excerpts of Carey's correspondence coming back to England and then making its way to America. And he was really challenged by hearing these missionary reports. In 1815, Peck met Luther Rice. One thing led to another, and he was appointed by the Triennial Convention to Missouri in 1817. Notice here, William Stoughton tutored him for a year in Philadelphia. This is pretty typical. Couldn't afford to go to school. A pastor would often tutor you to become a missionary or a pastor. William Stoughton was a member of that group that formulated the British Foreign Mission Society in 1792 in the parlor of a deacon in Kettering, England. William Stoughton was a student at Bristol College at the time, and eventually he became a pastor of Philadelphia. So he was a man very definitely involved in missions. Notice some of the examples of his labors, of John Mason Peck's labors. I mean, this is just breathtaking, and I have only included some of his exploits here. He wrote a journal, and he described one of his many journeys. If you'll notice, I've been absent from home 53 days, have traveled through 18 counties in Illinois and 9 in Indiana, rode 926 miles, preached regular sermons 31 times, besides delivering several speeches, addresses, and lectures. I've been enabled to revive 3 Bible societies. Today we would call these Bible studies, home Bible studies, which would never have been recognized but for my visit, to establish 7 new societies, to visit and give instruction in the management of 2 societies which had been formed without my aid, to provide for the formation of 4 others. I've been aided in forming 3 Sabbath school societies and in opening several schools where no societies exist, and improved many important opportunities to aid the great cause in various ways. Now, Lord, give me both gratitude and humility that I may praise Thee for all my success, and seeing my own weakness and insignificance, may sink into the dust of self-abasement, that I may never be proud or vain. During his 40-year ministry, Peck contributed to the establishment of 900 churches. He saw 600 pastors ordained into the ministry and 32,000 members added to the churches. And who today has heard of John Mason Peck? But what a tribute he is to our great God and Savior Jesus Christ. Isaac McCoy, we could say so much about him, the minister to the Indians. His great dream was to have a nation within the United States devoted to the Indians where they could be evangelized. That dream never came true, but that was always his ambition. But quickly, the procedure of planting new churches by means of itinerancy, by commission and now by itinerancy. Here's Hezekiah Smith, who was a chaplain in George Washington's army during the American Revolution. Smith labored 15 months, traveled 4,235 miles as an evangelist at large from the Philadelphia Association, preached 173 sermons, strengthened existing and started several new churches. Notice, strengthened existing and started several new churches. Sounds like a worthy goal for the Ecclesia Consortium, doesn't it? Afterwards, he accepted the pastorate of Haverhill, Massachusetts Baptist Church. And between 1740, 1790, 86 new churches were formed in Massachusetts, a work in which Smith and his fellows worked from the Philadelphia Baptist Association, in which he had an active part. We could read on. Again, we don't have time, but the indispensable requirement of church planning, often neglected, unfortunately, is prayer. These member churches of the Philadelphia Association would ask about it. I mean, we want to continue planting churches. We want to continue doing the work of the Lord. We don't want to become lukewarm. We don't want to fall into doctrinal error. So, in unison, they agreed we need to have designated times of prayer. And so the Philadelphia Association minutes are replete with requests by member churches for this kind of prayer we call concerts of prayer. And as a result of these concerts of prayer, the second Great Awakening took place in the East Coast, mainly in churches and in colleges. And the Kahookie Association, which was a Baptist association in the South, recorded approximately 1,500 converts added through baptism by the end of 1802. That is, from 1801 to 1802, 1 year, 1,500 converts. Well, we don't have time for the Sandy Creek Baptist Association. You can read about that for yourself. But let me draw some conclusions that perhaps we can use as a basis for discussing these statistics and maybe answer some of your questions. Churches were planted by individuals or other churches during the colonial period in American Baptist history. Certainly with the assistance of association like the Philadelphia Baptist Association. But the point is, the success of church planting hinged on individual initiative and leadership. That's what it boiled down to. Longevity of pastorates was common among early American Baptists and is a fairly reliable barometer of success in Baptist stability and growth. I mean, they faced enormous odds and made tremendous sacrifices in order to maintain their ministries. But 30, even 40-year pastorates were not uncommon. This speaks of commitment, folks, to the local church. Revival, especially the Great Awakening, was a major impetus in the zealous efforts of church planting ministries. Reproduction is the inevitable result of consecration. Carefully articulated doctrinal confessions, especially the Philadelphia Baptist Confession, were the instrumental means of theological conversion, both in New England and in the South. Many of these Arminian Baptist churches were converted to regular Baptist churches. And that brought about a strong unity in early Baptist history. Fifthly, the holy ambition of the early Baptists was not necessarily big churches, but more churches. And I come from a big church. And God has blessed our church in many ways, Inner City Baptist in Allen Park, Michigan. But our goal is to plant more churches. And if that means sending out folks from our church to do it, which we have, we want to continue doing that. Regular Baptist associations were facilitators of church and mission activity and advisory counselors to local churches, but they did not assume superior authority over their constituents. Their role was advisory. 7, local Baptist churches as well as associations of Baptists reserve the right of exclusion and expulsion from membership of doctrinal deviants. One of the real weaknesses, I think, in independent fundamental Baptist churches is the lack of church discipline. We're just not practicing like we used to. You take some of the old church minutes, some of the church minutes of any individual state, it's interesting to see, particularly in the colonies, during that period of time, there were many who were expelled from the church because of infractions that they weren't willing to repent of. They were not remiss in fulfilling their duty. Not a witch hunt, it was just a matter of maintaining the purity of the local church. And then, number 9, during times of financial prosperity. We're talking here Industrial Revolution in the early 1800s. Baptists used their wealth to finance church planting and missions. It was the linen business in Rhode Island that helped things go. What are we doing with the tremendous influx of money from an economy driven by the technology revolution? The reason America has enjoyed great economic prosperity is because of freedom. True freedom is the byproduct of biblical Christianity. The unction of biblical Christianity is the Holy Spirit's power through evangelism. If we fail to evangelize, we will fossilize. And then lastly, the particular Baptist led the way among Baptists in America in both domestic and foreign missionary endeavors. When particular Baptist Calvinist theology was in the ascendancy, folks, there was more per capita growth of churches, more missionary enterprise, and more church planting than with the general Arminian Baptists. The idea that biblical Calvinism necessarily impedes evangelism is absolutely false. Just the opposite is true. Genuine revival, doctrinally sound churches, and the forward movement of Baptist evangelism and missions have not only been aided, but have actually been driven by the doctrines of divine sovereign grace. And the last comment here is from the anniversary of the American Baptist Home Mission Society celebrating 50 years, 1832 to 1882. And this is from John Mason Peck. My mind is often deeply impressed with the thought that I am laboring for future generations. That includes us, folks. And that the principles inculcated and the habits introduced in the Baptist society in this country will last for ages. Under what high and weighty responsibility should every professor, that is, professing the Baptist faith, and particularly every preacher, that includes many of you and me, act who lays the foundations in a new country? Well, new territory. We still have a lot to do, don't we? In church planting, helping to establish new works for the Lord. Well, as usual, I bit off more than I could chew.